Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we're talking with Connor Town O'Neill, who recently wrote Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. Welcome, Connor.
Hey, Christina. Good to be with you.
I'm so glad you're here, and I understand that you have a special guest with you today.
That's right. I have my one-month-old daughter, Olive, sitting in my arms while we do this. And she might hop in if she has anything to add to the discussion with the book, but she's snoozing right now.
Well, we're glad Olive could join us. I wonder if we could start by having you tell us about yourself.
Sure. So my name's Connor O'Neill, and I'm a writer and a radio producer. This book, Down Along with That Devil's Bones, is my first book. I've been working on it for about 5.5 years now, so it's really thrilling to have it out in the world, although it still feels a little bit strange that it doesn't just live on my computer anymore. I also work on the podcast White Lies, and I teach English and and I teach English and screenwriting at Auburn University.
And so that leads me to my next question, which was, what was your own educational path?
Yeah, so I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I went to a public high school there, Penn Manor. And then from there went to Vassar College, which is a small liberal arts college in upstate New York. And then I got a graduate degree in creative writing from the University of Alabama. And that's it's at the University of Alabama where I started writing this book, then spent the couple of years since I finished that master's degree, pitching and luckily enough, you know, selling the book and then writing it.
And so you wrote it as part of your MFA work?
That's right. Yeah, it was it became my MFA thesis, which is actually it's kind of mind-boggling to think about because I finished my degree at the University of Alabama in the spring of 2017, which means that I had a draft of this book 3 months before the Unite the Right rally. Thinking about things that happened in the later part of the book, it just hadn't happened yet. So it's taken a couple of rewrites since then, but yeah, I finished at UA in May of 2017, and you know, it was very much a first draft, very much a rough draft of the book. There was still lots of reporting to be done, but I had wrapped, you know, the principal research and historical end of it. But then in the years since, have gone back and reported stuff more deeply and covered the stuff that's happened in the years since.
So I've read the book. So for me, this is a logical question. So no, I'm not throwing any shade, but why Alabama for graduate school?
I had been writing about the American South for a couple of years before I decided to go to an MFA program. While I was studying in undergrad, I became really obsessed with sampling in hip hop, and you know, the ways that producers were taking and remixing and recontextualizing old American music and making it new again, and just that that concept really floored me, and I was really taken with it, and so that sort of sent me on this kind of reverse course through 20th century music, so funk, disco, jazz, soul, and then ultimately early blues music, and so I started writing about that. And while I was at Vassar, I was working with Kiese Lehman, who is a great writer from Mississippi, who was teaching at Vassar at the time. And he was really encouraging me to write about music, but was also really encouraging me to actually go there. And so he helped me get a grant that where I was riding buses around the Mississippi Delta. And it was my first time in the South. It was my first time doing a real reporting trip. And that trip really sort of knocked the stuffing out of me in a productive way, I think, but really forced me to think about what it was that I was, why I loved the blues, and for good and bad reasons, and really getting a wider sense of the culture, the politics, the life experiences, the sense of place that was informing that music. It just got me really fascinated with the South. So over the next couple of years, I took a few more reporting trips there. During the Occupy Wall Street campaign, I traveled around the South again, sitting in with different Occupy movements in a couple of different Southern cities. And then, you know, after that trip, I really decided, you know, I think writing is what I want to do. It's really the only way that I can kind of make sense of the world and my place in it. So I figured I wanted to really devote myself to writing, and that if I was going to do that, I wanted to do it in the South, because it was, like I said, you know, a place that I was really fascinated with and was interested in things that were happening there in the past and also in the present. I kind of had this feeling that, like, if America was kind of get out of or really seek to address the crises that it's in, a lot of the productive work in that end was going to be happening in the South. And I had a kind of vague, I had that as a sort of vague feeling. And so I figured, you know, if that was going to happen, if I thought that was true, I wanted to be there for it. So I applied to really only applied to graduate schools in the South, and was accepted. And I was accepted at the University of Alabama, and it just seemed like a really great program, really great nonfiction program specifically. So it was kind of a no-brainer. One of the really nice things about the University of Alabama, in addition to it being in the South, was that it offers 4 years. Some MFA programs are only 2 years, but Alabama's is much longer. And so I had a lot of time to really apprentice as a writer, really get to know myself, have the time and the space and the support to do a lot of research and some travel. So it was a really powerful experience. It was a really supportive experience. And it's crazy to think, you know, I wouldn't have been able to produce a book like this if I didn't have that time and that space, that just, I wouldn't have been afforded had I gone somewhere else.
Yeah. When you're saying that it's a nonfiction program, creating a meaningful book length work of nonfiction in 2 years, plus just the acclimation space in the first semester or so of getting up to speed in an MFA program, it really only leaves you a year and change to try to write the entire work. So I can see why you were intuitively looking for a longer program to continue to have the ongoing mentoring and shaping.
That's right. Yeah, it was just the perfect program for me. And I think that some of the shorter programs really work for other people, different kinds of writers at different points in their lives. But that longer program certainly was perfect for me, because really I only stumbled across this story and into the spring of my second year, I had been working on other projects up until that point. So, I would have been, I would have been out before I had even really, skimmed the surface of the research required for this book, if I had only been there for 2 years.
Yeah. So why don't you give listeners the elevator pitch for this book, since we're referencing the book?
Yeah. So the book is about, it's a work of journalism that covers campaigns to remove monuments dedicated to the Confederate general Nathan Bedford Forrest in four cities across the American South. So in the years after the Charlottesville Nine murders, as these campaigns are aimed at Confederate symbols, flags, and monuments broke out, I covered those aimed at Forrest specifically. So there's a story in Selma, Alabama, Murfreesboro, Tennessee, Nashville, and Memphis. And it's about each of the monuments in those cities and the battles over whether they're going to stay up. It dips into some biography of Forrest and some Civil War history, but also uses that history as a lens for looking at the last 5 years in America.
Were you working while you were a student? Because you reference in the book that you were reporting on the monuments. Were you working as a journalist at the time as well as being in school?
Yeah, I was freelancing a little bit, just sort of following stories as they came up. I had published my first story on the day of the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, which is the attack by Alabama police officers on civil rights demonstrators on Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge back in 1965. I had written an essay about the design of that bridge and how it became a sort of symbol for the civil rights movement. And that was really my first, that was my first published piece. And that had gone live on Slate the morning of that anniversary. And I was in Selma that morning to do some more reporting on that anniversary. And that's where I stumbled across this story for the first time. So yeah, I was really just kind of getting my legs as a working journalist, as I started working on this story.
And how you stumbled across the story is very vividly explained in the book. Can you set the scene of that for the listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, it's the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. President Obama was there. This is 2015, so it's getting into the end of his second term in office. But he was there to deliver a speech and to cross over the bridge in remembrance. And just as an aside, that he delivered a pretty amazing speech that day. I think one of his best, and certainly one of the best presidential speeches in recent memory, and it's worth looking up. But anyway, so I think people expecting him to, really provide a thoughtful reflection on that day. 40,000 other people showed up to hear that speech too. And Selma's a pretty small city. 40,000 extra people showing up really kind of flooded downtown. And so when I show up, like I said, I'm a poor graduate student. I'm a broke graduate student at the time. And so I'm sort of scouring for free parking. And it occurs to me, oh yeah, Selma's got one of these cemeteries that's very sort of classic old South, magnolias, Spanish moss, mausoleums, its own system of roads. So I decide, oh, I'll just like go into the cemetery and stash my car somewhere. And, it's true. I did actually find some free parking there, but I also found way more than I bargained for too. So in that cemetery is also has a Confederate section where some Confederate soldiers are buried. There are a couple of monuments there, a big cannon. And I look over to that part of the cemetery and there are a bunch of signs that say Confederate Memorial Circle closed, do not trespass. And a couple of people sort of standing at the edge of that section scowling at me. It was a little bit intimidating, but it was also, that's kind of catnip for a reporter. So I wander over and just, engage them. What are you doing here? Are you guys standing guard? Like what's the deal? And they tell me this long story about how basically for the better part of the last two decades, they had been fighting about this monument of Nathan Bedford Forrest that they had put up. And putting up a statue of Forrest, who was a slave trader, an accused war criminal, the first Grand Wizard of the Klan, that's, you know, that would be controversial anywhere. And it is, and it is everywhere he is. It's controversial. But to do it in Selma, which is the sort of synonymous with Black voting rights, the city that gave the world the vote. It was, you know, that just sort of compounded the injury. And then it turns out that statue had first gone up in the fall of 2000. So one, not in like, you know, the aftermath of the war, but 150 years later, and the same week that the city had inaugurated its first Black mayor. So it was just this enormously controversial statue. That statue was eventually stolen, but its theft only sparked a new fight about whether this group, the Friends of Forrest, was going to be able to replace that statue. And so by the time I meet them in the spring of 2015, they were fresh off a victory in federal court that was going to allow them to put up a new statue of Forrest. So they were there that day, I found out, basically sort of preparing the grounds and getting ready for this unveiling of their new Forrest statue. And the dissonance of that experience, being there, thinking about the civil rights movement, the sacrifices and the bravery and the violence of that era, but then also having the first Black president in town, it was really easy to think about that day, you know, in terms of optimism, in terms of progress, you know, the symbol of the bridge of crossing over, sort of escaping our history or transcending our history. All of that was completely put to bed by this encounter that I had with these neo-Confederates. So I was left that day, one, just kind of wondering who Nathan Bedford Forrest was. Didn't really grow up on a lot of Civil War lore, but also wondering what it meant to put up a monument to him and to do it in 2015. So that day, that experience really stuck with me. I started to do some research on it, followed along as they unveiled their new monument. And then just a couple weeks after that new monument went up, the Charleston 9 murders happened. And this what felt for a little while as this sort of obscure, you know, bit of like public history and, you know, Civil War history essay that I was working on, suddenly exploded into a real national referendum. So I started to, you know, digging in much more and following stories in other cities too. But it all goes back to that day on the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday.
And the book is really you unpacking what the heck that moment was, where you were just trying to park your car and you find out really that the world is not what you thought it was. And as you try to work through the meaning of what you've encountered and what it means both for the South, for all of the things named after Forrest and for the people who are wounded by that, you also go on a journey of understanding what it means for you to be white, something you hadn't really had to look at before.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think for most of my life, I operated on a lot of sort of received wisdom about how race works in America. And just, you know, mostly sort of taking whiteness to be the kind of norm or like the stock photo. Like it is, we're encouraged to, if I can generalize, we're sort of encouraged growing up, white Americans are encouraged to just kind of take it as the norm that it just is. There's nothing to see here. And that race, insofar as it's a problem, is a problem for Black people. It's a problem for them and it's a problem for them to solve. And luckily, brave men like, you know, Martin Luther King stood up and marched and helped us solve this problem. You know, and it wasn't very self-reflexive about the ways that race has and does shape my life, and what whiteness is and where it came from and how it operates and how it works to sort of hoard power, resources, wealth, all of these things that it's convenient for white Americans to think we've sort of earned on our own and don't have to interrogate too much. But like you say, the process of working on this book had prompted me to really dig into it, you know, and to see that there's no biological basis for whiteness. It's a political identity, and political, not, you know, Democratic or Republican, but political in sort of how power is organized, that whiteness is an invented concept and a way of affording opportunities to, you know, pale skinned Europeans. And that, of course, that group is going to shift over time and has shifted over time. But I have fallen squarely within it and have, even if only passively and for a while unwittingly, you know, experience the benefits of that hoarding, of that racial hierarchy of this country. So looking at Civil War history, looking at the history of Forrest, looking at what these monuments meant, it became impossible after a while to do that and not understand my place in this, that I had a stake in these debates too. And so the course of reporting this also prompted a lot of self-reflection and understanding myself in the context of this country and the racial hierarchy that we have and the often violent ways that hierarchy is enforced.
And other things that you confronted were sort of this north-south divide that you thought maybe the nation had, that because you grew up in the north, a lot of these issues were something you could learn about, but that you didn't really have to. And sort of the divide of what was pre-Civil War and was post-Civil War is too tidy. And you really unpack more and more of this as you go through the book to say that if we bring it down to a Civil War issue, then it's easy to moralize the winner or the loser, to take a stance on that. But when you began truly trying to understand who Forrest was and why anybody still cared, you realized all the things that you hadn't seen, that streets were named after him, that his likeness was pinned up in the bulletin board of the coffee shop that you frequented, that his name was on schools, monuments, statues, counties, cities, his face was on t-shirts. And as you began to realize that he was everywhere, you wrote on page 8, in his symbolic afterlife, Forrest haunts the landscape. And the book is really you trying to understand the depth of that haunting and what it's doing to people. And that led you, as you say, to 4 different places to look at what was going on with monument battles. And one that I think will really resonate with listeners is the battle that was going on the MTSU campus over Forrest Hall. Could you talk to us about what led you there and what you found out?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the aftermath of the Charleston 9 murders, after Dylann Roof was arrested in Charleston, images from his blog started to circulate, and it became clear that he had taken this almost sightseeing tour around South Carolina, going to slave memorials, Civil War sites, plantations, cemeteries, and almost in a way to sort of steel himself for the act of terrorism that he would then go on to commit. So it was those images that really prompted this referendum on Confederate imagery and symbols. One of the campaigns that it inspired that summer was on the campus of Middle Tennessee State University that has a building named after Forrest on campus. The ROTC building there is known as Forrest Hall. And so that academic year, 2015-2016 academic year, students on campus there led a protest movement to try and get the school to change that name. And the school decided that they were going to form a task force to weigh this decision, if they were going to keep the name, change the name, or keep the name with added historical context. And they held 3 forums across that academic year where they heard from all comers. They heard testimony from students. They heard testimony from professors, from community members. And it was really just, it was a really polarizing, oftentimes upsetting, frustrating, and kind of ultimately futile battle about how Americans should remember Forrest. So there were very clear sort of pro keep the name and change the name camps. And they just kind of went back and forth. These forums were organized in a sort of tit for tat manner. So someone who wanted to change the name would get up and speak for 2 minutes. Someone who disagreed would stand up and speak for 2 minutes. And they would just go back and forth for hours. And this dragged on all year. And so it became a way, covering that story became a way of looking at a couple of really interesting things that were happening at the time. One, a really increased political polarization in the country. This is the moment of Black Lives Matter, but also a nascent Trump campaign. So you have the sort of Make America Great Again that has one view of history, in which, you know, there are sort of good old days, the politics of white grievance at work. And then on the other hand, people that want to hold America accountable to its past and to understand how that past of segregation, of lynching, of slavery, it continues to shape the American present, and that we need to be responsible and accountable to that. And those two camps just sort of went to war over Forrest. So it exposed this political polarization, but it was also one of many on-campus campaigns that were happening that year, trying to get universities specifically to be more responsible for the racial environment on campus. This, you might remember, this is the year where there are massive protests at the University of Missouri, a graduate student on hunger strike, the football team threatening not to play, big protests at Yale, Princeton, University of North Carolina, University of Texas at Austin, just sort of across the country. There are these real referendums on who's being honored at these schools, what that honoring means for students on campus then. I think it was put most succinctly by a student at MTSU who said at one of these forums that they would find an alternate path through campus because they didn't want to be reminded that the school was honoring someone who didn't think they were a human while they were walking to Nineham Biology. And I thought that really captured something essential about the debate that was happening at Middle Tennessee about Forrest, but also happening more broadly, and about how young Black Americans were, you know, really advocating for, insisting that these universities that they were paying tuition to attend actually do something to address the really toxic racial climate that was happening on these campuses. So yeah, I mean, there's a ton to unpack too about the school, and how over decades it had been using Confederate imagery and images of Forrest specifically. Back in the 60s, there was actually a student who would dress up as Forrest as the school's mascot and ride a horse up and down the sidelines of the football games. But really, as soon as the school integrates, there are the students of color really challenging the use of that imagery, the use of those symbols, the band playing Dixie, the 700-pound bronze medallion of Forrest that hangs outside the student center. As long as there have been Black students on campus, there have been protest movements to try and change or remove these Confederate symbols. And then finally, in 2015, 2016, the last symbol left on campus was Forrest Hall. So this was like the sort of last battle over Forrest at MTSU. And, you know, they, even though a lot of the students had grown cynical and weary over the course of that year and over the course of that protest campaign, one of the leaders of the movement actually published a letter in the local paper saying all Black students should transfer to HBCUs, because they had just sort of had it with MTSU and them dragging their feet about the name of this building, because to them it felt like a bad faith debate. they didn't, as the one of the leaders of the movement, Joshua Crutchfield, said to me, you know, we don't think racism should be debated at this point. And the fact that the school had gone about it in such a lengthy, polarizing way, just sort of underscored to them the extent to which they felt unwelcome there. So they had grown pretty cynical about the whole process, but the school actually did end up deciding that the name should change. But the school wasn't the last group that was going to weigh in on this. They had to then go to the Board of Regents that oversees the school and get their permission. The Board of Regents actually came to agree, yes, this name should be changed. But there's a law in Tennessee, the Heritage Preservation Act, that requires the state's historical commission to approve any, you know, name change with historical, that has historical relevance. And then that law was strengthened to require a supermajority of the historical commission to approve it. That law, the Heritage Protection Act, has sort of jokingly been referred to as the Nathan Bedford Forest Protection Act, because there are so many symbols of forest in Tennessee. Anyway, the school had to go before the historical commission to appeal to them to get permission to change the name of Forest Hall, and the commission denied their application. So Forest Hall remains Forest Hall.
It was flabbergasting, that section of the book, how many levels of approval it took when the school itself had decided, and yes, it's time to change the name, after the students had done such a tremendous amount of work. And you take us to that gruesome ping pong version of the hearing, where, as you said, people talk for 2 minutes on one side and 2 minutes on the other, and then back to 2 minutes on the opposing side. And it just must have been so gruesome for the students to sit there, to basically have every key point they make immediately negated by an opposing voice. And yet the school does come to the point where they say, all right, we can change the name. And yet there's like four other levels of bureaucracy to wade through before that can happen. And you referenced a moment ago Joshua Crutchfield and his op-ed to the local Daily News Journal. And in the book, you quote him as saying, in this op-ed, we don't have to beg institutions to be included, and we don't have to be where we're not wanted. And those sentences really summed up what you just shared about what it's like for someone to be on campus confronted daily by these artifacts of oppression. I wonder if you could also introduce us to another person who you spoke with while you were there doing the research, Sylvester Brooks.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned that there's a much longer history of the university's entanglement with Forrest and images of the Confederacy. And Sylvester Brooks was a student at MTSU, one of the first Black students to attend MTSU. He was in one of the first cohorts after the school had integrated in the 60s. And he led the first wave of protests to try and get MTSU to change or remove these Confederate symbols on campus. He told me this story about going to his first football game and just being encountered with all of this, you know, sort of carnival of the Confederacy. There are frat boys, you know, with like Confederate vests. There's the band playing Dixie, people waving Confederate flags, and the mascot, of course, on horseback riding up and down the side of the field in, you know, the gray wool of the Confederacy. It was shocking to him. But he was sort of a born activist. He had grown up in Memphis, had marched as a teenager, had received death threats from the Klan as a teenager. Even he told me that his mom kept a scrapbook of his activism, and he would text me photos that she would send him from it, you know. So I got to read this death threat that a member of the clan had sent this 17-year-old. And so his story, one, I think really laid out in a really eloquent and moving way why these symbols were so antithetical to what, you know, what needed to be done, the issues that America needed to face. You know, he talks about, you know, building this new future, the university and really the country living up to the ideals that it was professing of liberty and freedom and equality, and pointing out that these symbols that the school was using were completely antithetical to that, and that were about dehumanizing Black people and about you know, holding on to the old ways of exploitation and violence and this racial hierarchy that people were clinging to so tightly. He was saying there's a new, you know, we can find a new way to be, we can find a new way to organize this university, to organize this country, and to live up to these ideals that we've for so long claimed. And so he led this movement, he wrote letters, he was, you know, organizing, appealing to the student government, and was finally successful, or at least somewhat successful. He managed to convince the university to stop, have the band stop playing Dixie as the fight song, and to let go of Forrest as a mascot. But, you know, this massive bronze medallion of Forrest stayed up in front of the student center. And of course, Ozzy is stirring. And of course, Forrest Hall remained Forrest Hall. So yeah, it was really, sorry.
It's okay. We have her as our guest. We have to tend to her needs too.
Okay. You're okay. But yeah, so one of the things though that was underscored talking to Sylvester Brooks is that in one way or another, this school has been fighting the same fight for half a century. You know, as long as there had been students of color on campus, they had been fighting this fight over what it means to honor Forrest. And the school couldn't completely square to it or own up to what it was that they were doing when they were honoring Forrest, and who was affected by it.
And the journalist in you really sought out people from different walks of life to try to understand how pervasive the history of these monuments are for people and why anybody could still be fighting to keep them. And one of the people that you met was Stephen Murphy, mm-hmm. Who is the chaplain of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. And he even celebrates Forrest's birthday. Can you tell us about meeting him and how listening to him added in pieces to this complex story that you wouldn't have had otherwise?
Yeah, you're right. I really did approach this story as a journalist and wanting to understand why we were still fighting this fight. I had my own ideas about why what Forrest represented was, you know, horrific or abhorrent or, you know, antithetical to the kind of country I want to live in. But I didn't totally understand why he was still with us. And why people were willing to really go to the mattresses for him 150 years after the war had ended. So I sought out people in Murfreesboro and the surrounding areas who wanted that building to stay Forrest Hall. Of course, these forums made that really easy because they would come and testify, and then they became easier to find that way. Talking with Steve Murphy, I think, was really important in helping me understand a lot of the deeper issues at play, both with Forrest, but also in general, how white Americans think about our past and how it should teach us to understand our present. So talking to Murphy, and like you said, he celebrates Forrest's birthday. They eat the meal that Forrest ate when he led a raid through Murfreesboro and saved some prominent members of the town who were set for execution when Murfreesboro was briefly under Union control during the war. It was a pretty minor raid, all things considered, but people love Forrest and take any reason to celebrate him. So this raid that he led through Murfreesboro is cast in very, heroic terms. So they mark, they eat the sweet potatoes and black eyed peas that he ate that night after the raid, as a way of, honoring him and his bravery, I suppose. But one of the things that Murphy told me that was really important and really useful in understanding the deeper stakes of this debate was that he was saying, in reference to that, them eating the same meal that Forrest ate, he said, some people might think we're being overly romantic, but we're just trying to protect the Confederate soldier's good name. And I found that really a revealing quote, because I think you can really extrapolate out a lot from that. I think that is how a lot of us are taught to regard our history, that we have American exceptionalism, this idea that we're the greatest nation in the world, and by dint of our exposed values of freedom and liberty and justice, that, we're sort of distinguished amongst the nations of the world. And one of the things that American exceptionalism holds is that we're kind of entitled to a happy history, a good history, a history that flatters us. That there are, brave men who built this country and whose ideals, guided us to this, utmost moral standing in the world. That sort of puts blinders on us, and we can't possibly have a history that might ask something of us, or might hold us accountable to something, or might be something that has caused a lasting injury and that might require, redressing. So if we're only looking at history as a way of protecting the good name of the past, we're never really going to understand where we came from, and thus never really understand who we are. And if we can't understand who we are, then we're never really going to be able to change. And we're going to keep fighting these battles like the ones that we're fighting right now over Forrest. So that was a really helpful conversation, understanding the kind of ideology that undergirds some of this debate. And that couldn't be made more clear than in Murfreesboro, where there's a sign that marks where Forrest took a nap before this raid through downtown Murfreesboro. There are on the courthouse square, there are a bunch of markers that document Forrest's heroic raid. There's a statue of the Confederate soldier at the corner of the courthouse square. All of this sort of hagiography and honorifics to the brave men like Forrest, who is Tennessee's legendary soldier, as one person described him to me. But what goes unmarked is also just as important part of understanding the legacy of the Civil War. Off of one corner of the square, actually the corner where the Confederate soldier is looking, the statue of the Confederate soldier is looking, is where the slave market used to stand. And there's no marker that shows that's what that building used to be. It was spent a long time in the Heritage Center. They're trying to find exactly where the slave market was. And I think that juxtaposition, what's remembered and then the flip side of that, what's forgotten, I think is important to keep in mind. So the Confederacy was making no secret about why they were seceding and what they were fighting for. Vice President of the Confederacy, Alexander H. Stephens, talked about, that slavery was the cornerstone of the Confederacy. The Confederate president, Jefferson Davis, talked about how they justified slavery because the men and women that they were enslaving were inherently inferior, stamped by their creator is the phrase that he used. And of course, many of the Confederate soldiers fighting in the war were fighting to protect a sort of that racial hierarchy, even that sort of psychological sense of superiority that they had, because they were living in a system that was tilting the board in their favor. Whether or not they themselves owned slaves, they existed in a system in which slavery existed and was existing to their benefit, to their higher, standing in the hierarchy. So it was this idea of protecting slavery, expanding slavery into the frontier was absolutely the reason for the war and the motivation for the fighting of the war. And yet that goes totally unmarked in downtown Murfreesboro. And to go back to the thing that Stephen Murphy told me, you know, to protect the Confederates' good name, you can't think about just how ghastly, how morally bankrupt the spiritual and physical torture of slavery, and also all of the wealth that was extracted from that slave system that was enriching people, not just in the North, but banks in New York, factories in Boston. You know, it as the historian Edward Baptist makes clear in his book, The Half Has Never Been Told, like, slavery is the system by which American capitalism is developed. It's the way that we become this, this our economy becomes a behemoth in the world is through this slave system. So anyway, all of that to say, there's this dance of sort of remembering and forgetting that is happening with public images, public symbols of the Confederacy, that once you look into, you realize that, like, we have such a naive sense of what our the purpose of our history and what our actual history is. But when you look at it, when you look at it closely, you realize that there is no there's no good name to protect, and really that the Confederate history fits into a larger context of American history that is also predicated on this idea of you know, Black inferiority and promoting policies that work to the benefit of white Americans and at the expense of Black Americans. So, you know, it's hard to defend anyone's good name when you really start to look into our history and without the sort of rose tinted glasses that American exceptionalism offers to us. And maybe that's a good thing. You know, we should get over this naive view of our history and let history hold us accountable to the injustices and the injuries that have been, that have happened and let them, you know, let them hold us accountable to them in the present. So even in just the very geography of Murfreesboro, I was being taught these lessons about how memory worked, about, you know, how the past shapes the present, and how the Confederate symbols fit into all of that.
I know you're running short on time, so there's just one more person I want to take a few minutes to ask you about, because we're talking about the tensions between collective memory and history. And someone who's deeply working on that was a woman you met named Sarah Calise. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us about her project and how it fits into the narrative of this book?
Yeah, absolutely. So Sarah is an archivist at Middle Tennessee State, and she was incredibly instrumental to the research and the reporting of this book. She thinks of herself as sort of part archivist and part protester. So she was a graduate student at the time that this protest movement happened on campus. And so she participated in it, but was also documenting it too. At the same time, she was building an archive in real time. And I thought that was a really interesting project. But then she went way back. She was asking questions, not just about what's happening in the present and trying to document that, but looking back into the university's past and asking questions about where these symbols come from and what they meant and why they were being used. And so, you know, going through the archive with her and looking through, you know, speeches, imagery and letterheads, photographs from old homecomings and, you know, frat parties and football games, and looking through old yearbooks with her, just really, really getting a very textured sense of this history and the long connection that the school has with Forrest and with the Confederacy was really eye-opening and important. I'm really grateful to Sarah for all the great work that she's done and for sharing that with me.
This is an amazing book, and we've only had time to talk about just one of the four cities that you went to. So when listeners get a copy of the book, they'll see there's a lot more to unpack and get into when they read it. One of the things I wanted to ask you in the few minutes we had left is, what do you hope this book sparks?
It's a great question. I hope
writing it changed to you.
Yeah, I hope that this book sparks. I hope this book helps more of us get to. Let me take that again. I hope this book helps get us to a common understanding of our past that is rooted in the legacy of slavery and the lies that Americans have told to justify that system. Because even though the Civil War, the main consequence of the Civil War was the emancipation of enslaved Americans, the lie that we were telling ourselves to justify that just dastardly inhumane system perpetuated long after the war was over. That sense of that lie of black inferiority and that lie of white supremacy went on to be, you know, enshrined through Supreme Court cases, through redlining, through the social, who was eligible for the Social Security Act, the GI Bill, FHA loans, how schools are funded, how schools are zoned. I mean, just in every area of life, there are these policies that are meant to, or in effect, allow for the hoarding of resources for some people at the expense of others. And so what I hope that this book can do is get us to a common understanding of the past, of the American past, and the real injuries that have taken place in our past. And if we can have a solid grounding in a sense that our history doesn't need to flatter us, but that instead should hold us accountable, if we can get to that point, then we might be closer to getting a consensus for the really, you know, drastic policy changes that need to happen in this country. You know, in the 11th hour, though it may be, you know, we have massive work to do to close a racial wealth gap that stands at 10 to 1 right now. Make sure that everyone has access to good healthcare, to good education, that we can find a way of, you know, giving people jobs and addressing the climate crisis. Like, these are massive, massive, you know, programs and policies on the left that are going to need, you know, consensus building to happen. And I think if we can understand what the things that have happened in our past that have led us to this moment, we can stand a better shot of getting some consensus for addressing these lasting injuries. So that's a pretty lofty ideal, I know. And I don't flatter myself to think that it's this one book will do it, but hopefully it's a small step in that direction. Just a long, hard look at our past and understanding how that past has shaped our present.
And it's an honest look at your own reckoning too. When you ask yourself throughout the book, what debts do you owe to your own whiteness?
Yeah, that's right. And in that way, I hope it can be an instructive book. That my journey can sort of act as a surrogate for a lot of other people who are asking themselves those same questions right now. You know, it prompted me to look at things like how my parents were able to buy their house, you know, the sorts of mortgages that they were eligible. That, of course, has to do with their race. The neighborhoods that they could buy a house in, and thus what schools they could send their kids to, how, you know, me and my brothers were understood by our teachers, by police officers, how we were able to get loans co-signed to go to college because they had the backing of this mortgage, you know, all of these different ways that are subtle, but of course hinge on our race. And we might be only passively participating in these systems, but they're still shaping our lives. You know, that was one of the real revelations of the book, is that I might renounce everything that the Confederacy stood for, everything that Forrest fought for, but because they were fighting to maintain this American system of white supremacy, they were fighting for me. And I needed to understand myself and my life in the context of this racial hierarchy that is really, you know, a way of hoarding resources and opportunities that I had availed myself of. And that's not to be self-flagellating. That's not to induce some kind of self-loathing or shame, but just to understand myself in the context of this country, to understand the lines on which I was building my life, I was taking advantage of policies, systems, longstanding policies and systems that were providing me with all these opportunities. And to say that race didn't have a role in that would be to, you know, pull the wool firmly down over my eyes. So yeah, it's just, you know, it's just another way of holding yourself accountable, understanding how power in this country works, how opportunities in this country work. And we will never hope to be another way. We'll never hope to address the inequities in that, in those systems, if we can't be honest about how they work on an individual level, as well as on a more structural level. So yeah, there were a ton of personal revelations here that this reporting prompted. And like I said, I hope that other people who are going on similar journeys right now can find stuff that resonates with them.
And I think one of the things the book does is surprise people that journey is necessary. It seemed to catch you by surprise. One of the things I was struck by is that you were able to move safely about throughout the South. Mm. And that's not something that, for example, a female student could take for granted. It's not something a trans student could take for granted. And it's certainly not something a student of color who suddenly moved to the South would assume to be a given, that they could move about freely, particularly to contentious spaces, which is something that you were able to, and I'll assume you are safe because you're still here, that you are able to willingly do and get through with enough safety.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. And it's one that I really took for granted, especially early on in reporting, but again, sort of came to see through the process of digging into these stories. Yeah, absolutely. That I could move with safety because of who I am and how I'm understood in the way that this country works and who it protects and who it makes vulnerable. Yeah, absolutely. I tried not to take it for granted, and I tried to actually use it as a sort of a way of guiding the work after a while. Once I came to some of these epiphanies, naive as they may sound, once I started to realize, you know, my own subject position in the context of this country and in the places where I was reporting, one, I tried to not make it a given, but to understand my point of view on this, but then to realize that, yes, I could do this safely and people would talk to me who might not talk to other people. And then to sort of take that on, it's like, okay, well, if you're going to talk to me, then this is my work to do, you know, understanding that this is, you know, white people have for so long felt like it's not their responsibility to talk about race. But again, you know, as a white person, I've tried to take that on as my responsibility, to not let that be the problem of, you know, Black Americans, to try and save white people from this horrific and violent system that we've enacted. But instead to talk about it myself, to understand it, to understand the problem of race in this country as a problem made by white people for the advantages of white people. So to understand myself in that system and in a not very flattering position in that system. But then to, you know, take on the responsibility of talking about it, documenting how it operates and, you know, analyze how it operates as a way of, you know, getting more people to see it and to hopefully find ways of undoing it. And yeah, you're right. Like people, and because people would talk to me, I felt all the more, you know, responsibility to go out and talk to people. And that had to do with my whiteness, but you're right. It also had to do with the fact that I'm a cisgendered straight guy, and that, you know, a lot of people who would be hostile to talking to other people wanted to talk to me because they thought they could give me the hard sell and might convert me, you know, because I think it felt self-evident to them, like, oh, of course you should like this dude. We're doing this for your benefit. So I don't mean to be flip about that, but I think that was, that was certainly one of the forces that was shaping the reporting. And it was, like you said, I think it was important to be conscious of it and know that it was because of the particulars of my identity, it was sort of my work to do.
This is really a fascinating book and a fascinating journey that you went on. One of the quotes that I think sums up this conversation that we've had today really well is a person you spoke with who told you that the The forest statues represented a symbol of everything we are fighting every day.
Mm.
And that's how I think that that's a really poignant quote, and it really illustrates the depth of the things that are being fought every day still in our country. Thank you so much for being here today, Connor. We've been talking about Down Along With That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler. You're listening to New Books Network. Please join us again.